95 KSAN, that's Crystal Gale with Never Gave Up On Me. It's a little past 11 o'clock. Paul McCall here, and I'm getting ready to take off. PJ Ballard will be with you at 2 o'clock. So have a good week and start off the week with a smile. Time for the gay life.
This is the Gay Life, KSAN's public affairs show for gentlemen who prefer gentlemen, for women who prefer women, and for people who prefer people. You don't have to be gay to listen. Good evening, I'm Randy Alfred. Tonight on The Gay Life, we're presenting a witty and insightful address by author Gore Vidal, who delivered his trenchant remarks on the State of the Union to the Golden Gate Business Association on January 28th. Vidal's address is aired on KSAN, courtesy of the Kedick Lecture Bureau. Later in tonight's show, you'll also hear the presentation of the GGBA's Community Service Award to David Kessler, M.D., but first, novelist, author, wit, social critic, raconteur, and lecturer, Gore Vidal.
I wanted to start, as usual, tonight with a prayer. But instead, I will tell you the latest Nancy Reagan story. When she was told that the deserving poor would get all of that cheese, she said, "Good. Let them eat quiche." You can't beat compassion like that. I've got a brand new State of the Union tonight. And as the evening is going on, I've dropped agriculture and transportation. So there are one or two things I left out. But on the other hand, the president left out the union a couple of days ago. I'm going to have to resort to my cards from time to time. You remember these things from the last election. You know, it's, "Hello, I'm Ronald Reagan." I was talking to Johnny Carson, and Carson said, "I move only in the highest circles." And Carson said, "Have you noticed how Reagan, whenever he's asked a question, always first looks down to the ground, then slowly looks up and says, 'Well, why?'" And I said, "Well, he looks down because in the old westerns, that's where your dialogue was written, at your feet. And he's sort of hoping there'll be a line there." So I may have to resort to reading a line or two here, but I will look up from time to time in order to give an air of spontaneity to what I'm about to say. In fact, one of the greatest reader of cue cards was a president called Eisenhower, who always read his cards with a real sense of discovery. In 1952, when he was running for president, we were in one of our numerous wars at the time with Korea, and Eisenhower was mumbling away, and he said, "And if elected president, I will go to Korea." And the poor old thing was elected, and he was sent off to Korea, and there was no golf. I must say, Reagan was wonderful. I was in Santa Rosa this morning speaking to a somewhat conservative group, and they said, several very nice elderly ladies said, "Well, you've got to say one thing for him. I mean, that was brilliant, that State of the Union, you know. I mean, the way he had no notes or anything." And I explained that it's on two teleprompters. There's one on the left and one on the right. And you can look through it. From this side, it looks like glass. On his side, there's the dialogue. So he can look over here and he said, "Well, the budget today is high." And then he looks over here and reads off that part. And these poor ladies were thinking, "Oh, the contents of that mind." So I will give you my State of the Union. I've got a couple of notions about war and taxes, the only two things of huge urgency facing us. First of all, there is something I think very wrong with the United States of America today, and there has been something very wrong for quite some time. We have a one-party system that is the creation of those great financial interests that have controlled our country off and on, but mostly on, since 1786. Our single-party system is currently divided into two factions. One is called Republican and the other is called Democrat. This division is supposed to give us a sense of choice at election time, sort of on the order of painkiller X is better than painkiller Y, but each is aspirin. So in the absence of political parties, it is not surprising that we have no politics at the national level, as opposed to elections, where those who do vote provide a sort of Greek chorus to a drama over which they have no control. As a result of this absence of real politics, half of those qualified to vote never vote at all. And there are now signs that those who do vote are beginning to realize that it makes no difference on the national level who wins any election, because taxes and inflation will continue to increase as our real income decreases. And though the budget for the Pentagon will always expand in response to whatever enemy the enemy of the month club has sent us, we can be sure that the poor will get poorer, the rich will get richer, and the middle class, which is the country, will continue to carry the better part of the tax burden. You know, today for middle-income people, they pay 26 cents on every dollar goes to government. The corporations, particularly the top 500, according to Fortune, now pay no tax at all on vast earnings. As we approach this year's elections, our single-party candidates are now telling us that we need to give the Pentagon even more money because the Soviet Union has outstripped us militarily. This is not true, of course, but it sounds alarming, particularly when we are told that the Soviets will come flying through the vulnerability window. Give Reagan credit for an occasional burst of candor. When he was interviewed by Dan Rather, "Oh," he said, "the Russians are ahead of us. There's this vulnerability window thing." And he started to laugh. I don't know whether it had not been explained to him what it meant. But it sounded funny to him. Because of the Soviet Union, Reagan wants to give the Pentagon $1,500,000,000 over the next 5 years. And yet, no matter how much money we spend on defense, it is never enough. Why is this? No professional politician is going to answer that question, because if he did, he would lose his professional status. The best that he can do is remind us that life
is worse in the Soviet Union than it is here. This is quite true, but so what? What is that to do with the fact that schools are being shut down, that 50,000 businesses went bankrupt last year, the city streets are a battleground, and unemployment, the actual rate, is about 11 million people? The professional politician has no answer to any of these problems, partly because he is by definition a part of the problem. Press him too hard and he will tell us, in the immortal words of Spiro Agnew, that the United States, for all its faults, is still the greatest nation in the country.
This is The Gay Life on KSAN in San Francisco. You're listening to a lecture by author Gore Vidal to the Golden Gate Business Association.
I am rather taken by history, so I like to put things in historical context, which is sometimes wearisome, but I date the beginning of our problems to the year 1847, when The City and the Pillar was published. When the United States attacked Mexico in order to seize a great deal of land. And the young Ulysses S. Grant, who was just out of West Point, fought in that war. At the end of his life, Grant, who wrote one of the great memoirs of all time, he's one of our best prose writers, if worse presidents, he said of our theft of Mexico's land, "To us, it was an empire of incalculable value, but it might have been obtained by other means. The Civil War was largely the outgrowth of the Mexican War. Nations, like individuals, are punished for their transgressions. We got our punishment in the most sanguinary and expensive war of modern times." Well, I tend to accept Grant's somewhat metaphysical view that there is a rude justice in human affairs. As the Civil War was a judgment on the United States for what we did to Mexico, so the unraveling of the American polity in the last 30 years has been the result of our unremitting hostility, open or covert, to practically every nation on earth. Our rulers have tried to make this nation the military master of the world. Why? Because war has been the business of the United States for almost half a century. Why? Because it is through war or its threat that those who control the economic life of the country can make maximum profits, and the door of the treasury is always open to them. I know that the past is literally a closed book for most of our countrymen. After all, if we understood our own past, not to mention the history of our race, we would not allow ourselves to be so misgoverned and exploited by our rulers. But the schools belong to them, not to mention the media, and so we are obliged to live in a constant, anxious present, threatened on every side by enemies that are very often totally imaginary. You know, for those of you under 45, the fact that the United States is a nation forever at war, hot or cold, is a fact of life. You have never known anything different. It is now 40 years since the Japanese attacked us at Pearl Harbor. Since then, we have fought bloody wars in Korea and Southeast Asia and cold wars in every other continent. Now, Ronald Reagan, in the bright springtime of his senescence, is arranging, if not the next world war, something pretty hot, perhaps in Nicaragua or El Salvador. It doesn't much matter where, because as Reagan's self-styled vicar on earth, Alexander the Great Haig, has said, this is unbelievable, apropos Argentina, why we were supporting them. He said, we'll support any regime, no matter how dictatorial, that believes in one God. Well, it's at least a twist on our usual line about freedom and democracy. We now want to make the world safe for monotheism. The notion that war is good for business took hold in the wake of the Depression. In the late 1920s, our financial institutions collapsed. Although the country was as rich as it had ever been, and a lot richer than it is today, there was huge unemployment and financial chaos. The government was powerless to do anything but serve the great interests, and they were cutting their losses. And there was 25% unemployment. In the 30s, the New Deal pushed the country toward a sort of welfare state, and the Depression lessened. But it had not ended when the Second War began. During the war years, we had full employment for the first time in decades, while an entire generation was helped by the armed services, who fed and clothed and housed them better than many of them had ever known before. Those of us who served in the Second War assumed that when we got out of the military, we would be looked after by a grateful nation. And so we were, unlike the victims of more recent wars. We had the GI Bill of Rights. We also assumed, and here comes the crux and the beginning of our great problems, we assumed that the war industries would shift over to peacetime manufacture. There were a lot of things to be done internally. We needed new railroad systems, mass transit, slums to be repaired. There was a great deal to be done internally. Externally, we were the most powerful nation in the world. From 1945 to 1950, we alone had the atomic bomb. Germany, Japan, and the Soviet Union had been pretty much knocked out by the war. So if ever a nation was on top of the world, it was us in 45. Our rulers were then faced with a choice. Either we could repair and perfect our own country and be what we were intended to be, a great commercial power in the world, or we could continue to maintain a large military force for which arms must be made in order that we might be the world's military master or policeman, which was the word we used to use in that innocent time. The financial interests made their choice. We would be the world's policemen. We would fight communism day and night until we had defeated this terrible disease. I was speaking the other night in Irvine, and a lady got up and she said, I have two questions. One, what can I, as an average housewife, do to fight communism? The second, Mr. Vidal, what is communism? Well, the Greeks have a word for what we did and are doing, and you know the word is hubris. We had and we have neither the intelligence nor the wealth to govern the world. But once the decision was made to turn the country into a garrison state, it was necessary for the politicians and the media to convince the people that we were in such mortal danger that the Treasury must give the Pentagon a blank check. So the Soviet Union, which had barely survived the war, was suddenly turned into a huge monolithic octopus with tentacles everywhere on Earth. It must be said that a good job was done and the Cold War was off to a flying start. We had given tacit approval at Yalta to the Soviet Union that they had the hegemony of Eastern Europe, and they responded by shoring up their ramshackle empire, and they strangled all resistance in Hungary, East Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia. Then they acquired atomic weapons. Meanwhile, we had discovered a brand new enemy, China. The yellow peril of the last century had suddenly turned red on us. So to contain China, we fought in Korea. To contain China, we fought in Southeast Asia. But the Vietnam War took such a long time that even before the war had ended, the attention span of our rulers had snapped. Suddenly, my favorite American politician, Richard Nixon, wandered off to Peking. Now, nobody quite knows why, but there suddenly he was. And he met Mao Tse-tung, who turned out to be a pretty good American, after all, as your average red Chinese goes. But as Nixon said, 1 billion Chinese drink a lot of Pepsi-Cola. This, of course, is true, but a lot of us knew that all along. In 1960, I was the only congressional candidate in the country to advocate the admission of Red China to the UN. Better trade than war, I said. But I didn't realize then, we were all pretty innocent, that a garrison state must fight an occasional war in order to convince the long-suffering taxpayer that his money is well spent. After Nixon's trip to Peking, the Vietnam War made no sense at all. But we must give them our friends credit for a sense of humor. We are in Vietnam and Cambodia, they told us with an absolutely straight face, in order to save those Southeast Asians who love freedom and democracy from those North Southeast Asians who hate freedom and democracy. So finally, the long, bloody, expensive war was fought for no reason at all, except to give taxpayers money to the real enemy, our military, industrial, political complex. The war was a fraud, except for those who died or were wounded. And for them, it was, and it is, a tragedy of obscene proportions. Now, Mr. Reagan and the Bel Air Crusaders decided that a war, just about anywhere, is a necessity. One lucky thing, perhaps, for us is they're pretty vague about history and geography. They don't much care whether the war is in Nicaragua or Angola or Pakistan. All they know is that war is good for the business of the sort of business people who have been financing Mr. Reagan for the last 17 years. The entire AWAC deal was simply an $8.5 billion giveaway to Boeing. It had nothing of any political importance. Also, with wartime powers, you can silence your critics, you can lock up dissenters, you can empty the treasury, all in the name of freedom. Luckily, a few months ago, when Haig tried on El Salvador for size, he found that Congress and the media were not very enthusiastic. So the question now being asked at the White House is, if the next war can't be a small, manageable one, are we ready for the big time? Can we fight and win a limited, unlimited, non-nuclear, nuclear war to show the whole world that we are still whatever it is we're supposed to be? All eyes are now in the Middle East. We lost the Shah. Then we lost Iran, which, if you remember, George Washington specifically left us in his will. Now we've lost Sadat. Will we lose Egypt? Will we lose the oil fields? Well, thanks to the clumsiness and mismanagement, we do indeed have real problems in the Middle East, which do affect, or could affect, our security and well-being. But I must say, just to follow the muddled way that the administration has gone about preparing for this war, before the election, Reagan came up with the following scenario. Since the Soviet Union is running out of oil and natural gas, they will take advantage of the mess in Iran and seize all the Arab oil fields. To the election, Mr. Reagan asked the CIA for a report on Soviet resources, and the CIA, bless their black hearts, sent back word that the Soviet Union has enough oil for the rest of the century and more natural gas than they know what to do with. Outraged, the White House sent the report back for a rewrite. Second version was pretty much like the first. That's Warner Brothers.
Finally, the new chief of the CIA told the White House what they wanted to hear. A collapsing Soviet Union, desperate for oil, will soon be on the march. And so, once again, the United States, the Clark Kent of freedom, must go back into that telephone booth. This would all be genuinely funny if it weren't so dangerous. Last year in L.A. during the campaign, George Bush assured us that we could survive pretty easily a nuclear war. I don't know if you saw it last week, the administration told us that we've got to prepare civil defense, that we could not only we could survive very well, we have to go out and dig lots of trenches, fairly deep, and put boards over them and a lot of earth, about 2 feet of earth, and twigs over that. Then after the nuclear explosion, we can come out in a few days and we can recognize each other at night because we'll be shining. And when somebody pointed out to him, but what's there to come back to? I mean, everything's polluted and there won't be any cities. They'll all be knocked down. He said, you know, whenever you kick over an ant hill, the ants always rebuild it. I suppose this is the Reagan plan for urban renewal.
This is The Gay Life on KSAN in San Francisco. You're listening to author Gore Vidal address the Golden Gate Business Association.
Two out of three Americans have now been psyched into thinking that war is inevitable. As Reagan said last year, the Soviet Union underlies all the unrest that's going on. If they weren't engaged in those games of dominoes, there wouldn't be any hot spots in the world. Well, if he really believes this, he's a lot simpler than one suspects. If he does not believe it, then he is dangerous to us all. What is now plain is that if we continue to waste upon the military the $1.5 trillion they are to get over the next 5 years, we'll be faced with one of two things: a nuclear war and the end of the road for this particular civilization, or the bankruptcy of the United States. There is no third alternative. When I got out of the Army 35 years ago, if somebody had said to me our troops would still be in Europe in 1981, I would have laughed. I mean, it was a crazy notion. But they're still there with ground troops that are not meant to fight because they're too ill-trained, not to mention outnumbered. They are hostages to our allies to make sure that should our troops be endangered, we would strike back at the Soviet. Well, Western Europe is now much richer and more populous than we are. Since many Europeans don't want us there at all, and those who do want us there don't want to help us pay the bills, and there's currently $83 billion a year for NATO, I would say let them look after their own defense, at least on the ground. Let us bring home the troops. Certainly, we should maintain air and naval bases in the area if they want us to. If they don't, well, we can use the $83 billion here at home. That will just about cover the official deficit. At the moment, 60% of the Pentagon budget goes for the defense of Japan, Korea, and Western Europe. I think a lot of this can and should be paid for by those prosperous nations. And if this were done, we could easily and safely cut the military budget for 1983 by 25%. To defend the United States, we need well-trained and well-paid technicians whose task is to provide the country with a defense so total as to discourage an attack from anywhere. The maintenance of a large land army is pointless unless you are planning to make wars of aggression on weaker nations, let's say in Latin America. And if you want to do that, you will have to reinstitute the draft. And if you reinstitute the draft in what, despite the best efforts of our governors, is still peacetime, you will have a rebellion. Because the very notion of a peacetime draft runs contrary to everything the United States is supposed to represent. Unfortunately, our rulers are becoming increasingly more arrogant and totalitarian-minded.
They would like to control all our lives totally. To this end, they would like to draft the young, which in peacetime is simply enslavement. They harass the middle class with the IRS, an extortion racket that could have taught the Gestapo a trick or two. They keep tabs on millions and millions of us through thousands and thousands of spies in the CIA, FBI, DIA, DEA. You know, we have more spies spying on Americans within the United States than the Soviet Union has spying on their people. This is intolerable. You know, to be blunt about it, in a sense, we are an occupied nation, and it will take great effort, perseverance, and education to free ourselves peacefully from those who have taken charge of the garrison state that we have become. Now, it is no news that professional politicians seldom tell us what they think, but it should be noted that professional politicians seldom think. I exempt. I exempt from this, naturally, John Molinari, Nancy Walker, Richard Hungisto, Siamo Tutti Italiani qui stasera, Wendy Melder, and Doris Ward. The others are under my UKs. By and large, politicians respond to what the polls tell them. This means Monday, yes to the peripheral canal, Tuesday, no to the peripheral canal, Wednesday, yes to spraying, Thursday, no to spraying. I've been criticized for saying that there's no real difference between Republican and Democratic candidates anywhere. Obviously, there are differences between individuals. But on the main issues of war and peace, defense and taxes, they are all pretty much alike, and I find that frightening. You know, in 1970, we have something in Los Angeles which you will now have as it has gone national. It is called Regis Philbin. And the Regis Philbin show has been going on for years, and Regis has finally, has always been in Los Angeles, but now the rest of the country will share him with us. And in 1970, I said just this on his program, an election was going on, and Regis said, oh, Gore, what can you, how can you say this? We had the Republican Reagan is running against the Democrat UNRRA, the Democrat Tunney for governor. The Democrat Tunney is running against George Murphy, the Republican, for Senate. How can you say they're all alike? They're different people with different ideologies, different party labels. What do they have in common? Regis likes rhetorical questions, so I said, well, I'll tell you one thing they have in common. It's something called O'Melveny and Myers. And what, said Regis, is that? Or are that? He may have been grammatical. I said, well, that happens to be one of the largest law firms in the world. It's located in Los Angeles. And it represents every great financial interest in the state. And this law firm, O'Melveny and Myers, is handling all four campaigns. They're handling Reagan and they're handling UNRRA. They're handling Tunney and they're handling Murphy. Oh, boy, you can't mean this. There I was tearing up the flag again on his program. It was one of those programs where people can phone in. So there was a white phone in front of us. And I said, can we phone out, Regis? I guess we can. And I said, well, let's call O'Melveny and Myers. Because I had remembered that the man there who was handling John Tunney's campaign was Warren Christopher, soon to become a major diplomat years later. So he rings up Warren Christopher, O'Melveny and Myers, gets Mr. Christopher. And with tears in his tiny eyes, Regis said, is this true, what Gore says, that you're handling all four campaigns? Warren Christopher said, no comment. Now we know how the captives got freed. I think that is a pretty good example of how the country, in a sense, is governed, why we actually have no politics.
And why there are so few voices that speak out, I haven't heard one single voice on the subject of the Pentagon budget. They are all terrified to say that this thing is too large. We cannot afford it. And meanwhile, welfare, everything else is being cut back, CETA, programs that might increase the wealth of the country. It seems to me tragic that we have not developed politics, but we had better begin to try. To me, one of the most mysterious things about our society, and I was certainly thinking about it tonight, listening to the various speakers, is the acceptance on the part of just about everybody that government has a perfect right to control our private lives. Unless one is rich, children must be educated where government commands. This means that they will be taught what government wants them to know. In a haphazard way, government tells us whom we can have sex with, what we may or may not watch, read, eat, drink, smoke, put into our veins, as well as when and where and if we can gamble. Meekly, we have accepted a paternalistic society of a sort more suitable for old Europe than for the Republic of Jefferson and Madison. I'm told anywhere 30, 40, 50%, your police chief here will correct me, of all police work has to do with victimless crimes, with gambling, prostitution, drugs. Eliminate these so-called crimes from the statute books and you will automatically double your police force without spending a penny. I believe that we should really dismantle a paternalistic society in favor of a grown-up society. If anyone wants to kill himself with drugs, alcohol, or cigarettes, he has every right to do so because our lives and our deaths should belong to us and not to the state. The time has come to get the government off our fronts. In hoc signo vincemus, for Latin scholars. This year, all of our candidates are trying to outdo one another with let's get tough with criminals, let's have more law, more order, more prisons, more police. I love Mr. Duke Majan going around. He is so much for law and order that he's now trying to depict Mayor Bradley as handing out switch knives at the back of City Hall as being somehow weak on crime. You know, every year since I can remember, the FBI has told us that since crime is increasing in America, we must increase the FBI budget. And we do. And then a year later, they tell us that there is even more crime than the year before. Now, I don't suggest that if we cut the FBI budget, that crime will decrease. Now, there's something wrong. And I suspect that a lot of it is a cumbersome, unjust, expensive legal system which isn't plainly doing its job. For reasons obscure to me, murderers and violent people tend to be let free, particularly if filled with sugar, rather more soon than late, while sinners and minor offenders against property get eternal sentences. Obviously, we must protect our society from the violent. Compulsive brawlers, rapists, murderers should enjoy a well-earned seclusion at the state's expense. That would be something like a third to 40% of the current present population. The remainder, particularly those who are only guilty of sin in the eyes of the one God, and those who are guilty of minor crimes against property, should be paroled, because the cost of increasing the number of parole officers is a fraction of the cost of building those new prisons dreamed of by politicians whose friends happen to be contractors. We should also adopt on a national scale the Scandinavian system of obliging someone who has robbed or injured another to pay him back out of wages earned. It's my view that we cannot afford financially or morally the prisons that we have, much less build new ones. But if we don't rehabilitate the prisons that we do have, we may find ourselves being treated by the civilized world like a barbarous adversary nation
on the order of the Soviet Union. Prison reform will be difficult because there's a lot of money in prisons. In the state of New York, it costs the state slightly more to keep one man in prison for a year than it would be to send to Harvard, where he could at least learn to commit his crimes without being caught. A lot of Harvard graduates here, I see. Incidentally, one excellent way of raising revenue at the moment, right now, would be to tax all of the religions. It has been estimated that a tax on the earnings, both portfolio and television, of our numerous cults would yield close to $100 billion a year. That would be quite enough to service the national debt. And Mr. Falwell, under the First Amendment, would have every right to ask us to send him money to keep for Jesus, but the IRS should be standing there right beside him to take their cut. Ultimately, all our problems boil down to the one issue: war or peace. Shall we stop our nearly half century of war so that we can repair and perfect our own country? I think we can. I know we must. It is unusual for one writer to end quoting another writer, but I will quote a very great English writer, Bertrand Russell, who was a conscientious objector at the time of the First World War and was put into prison. And from prison, he wrote these words to a friend: "Let us keep before our minds constantly the thought of serving the world, not some derivative principle, nor pride, nor desire to confute our opponents, but the positive desire to nourish life in the world rather than to minister to death. War develops in almost all a certain hysteria of destruction, self-destruction among the more generous, but still destruction. We have to stand out against this hysteria and realize, and make others realize, that life, not death, however heroic, is the source of all good."
That was author Gore Vidal addressing the Golden Gate Business Association. And this is The Gay Life on KSAN in San Francisco. Next, you'll hear GGBA Awards Committee Chair Arthur Lazare to present the GGBA's Community Service Award to David Kessler, M.D.
A few years back, we had a group that has been succeeded by a stronger coalition, but we had a group that was called the Fourth Thursday Group, which I guess went into business about 1979, and it was members from different organizations around town who would meet once a month, different gay and lesbian organizations, and we'd meet once a month and exchange information, and we did pursue a few short-lived strategies. It was the start of coalition within our community. And one of the people who showed up at those meetings, I used to go to them, and one of the people who showed up at those meetings said to me at one time, we were having a general conversation, and he said, "You know, we're creating a community here," which is something I personally believe very strongly in. "We're creating all the institutions of a community among gay people in San Francisco and other cities and in this country. And one of the things a community needs is a sense of history. And we're starting to develop some of that. Of course, gay history has mostly been suppressed. The historians in our community are now starting to dig some of that out. But history is not only digging up what happened in the past, but what we're doing now and the record that we create of that for the future." And at the time, I was president of GGBA, so I said, "How can we help create some history?" And I came up with the idea of this thing. This is the GGBA Community Service Award. And the board of directors created it in 1979. It was first awarded at this dinner in 1980. The resolution of the board said that it would be awarded to a person or organization deemed to have made significant and lasting contributions to the good and welfare of our community. And since we are creating a sense of history with it, I think it's appropriate to tell you about the past two winners. I think this is a roll call of honor that should be made each year. 1980, the first year that it was given, it went to gay rights advocates for the important work that they do in advancing the cause of lesbian and gay civil rights in the courts. In 1981, last year, it went to Randy Alfred, who's sitting down in front of me busily taping this program for his radio show. Randy is a gay journalist who gets the many messages of our community out on the air through his radio program and in print through the press. Since we gave this to him, he became the editor of the Sentinel. Last year, in particular, he got this award because he was the one, by himself and without anybody backing him, who put together the very important complaint that went to the National News Council about gay power, gay politics, the horrendous documentary, so-called, that CBS did and maligned our community. And it was Randy Alfred, the one power of that one journalist, who brought CBS to their knees. This year's winner is David R. Kessler, Dr. David R. Kessler. Let me tell you something about him, and then you can clap for him, because I don't think most of you know how much he's done. David is a psychiatrist at the Langley Porter Psychiatric Institute here in the city. He's an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of California School of Medicine, and was one of the very first in that organization to come out to his colleagues and stand up as an upfront gay person. He's been a psychiatric consultant to more organizations than you can imagine, including the San Francisco County Superior Court, the United States District Court, the United States Attorney's Office, the Federal Defender's Office, and the California Youth Authority. He lectures and writes prolifically. I've seen the list. I don't know how he does it. Article after article and lecture appearance after lecture appearance. And he especially talks on the subject of psychotherapy for lesbians and gay men. Talking not only to gay therapists, but to straight therapists and telling them how properly to deal with their and lesbian clients. He also talks a lot about homophobia, a disease that a lot of people need to know a lot more about and that we have to learn how to cure, which I think is something we're all working on. From 1970 to 1980, David served as president of, and the first president, of Bay Area Physicians for Human Rights, helping BAFR to achieve national recognition as a professional medical organization. In 1980 and through and to the present time, he has been serving as president of the Caucus of Gay, Lesbian, and Bisexual Members of the American Psychiatric Association. And in 1981, just last year, he was elected to the board of directors of the National Gay Task Force. And the amazing thing about David Kessler is two things. Number one, he was the one who said to me, we have to create a sense of history. And it was he that inspired this very trophy. I don't think he had any idea back then that he might one day be a winner of it, because the trophy was my idea. The underlying need for it was his. In amassing all of the accomplishments I've told you about, somehow this man still maintains a warm sense of humor and to me, very important, a deep sense of ethics and integrity. And I love him very much. Come on up and get your trophy, David.
Thank you very much, Art. You read the talk that my mother prepared, I think, very well. I would like to say thank you to all of you. I think it is you who deserve the award. This magnificent group of movers and shakers, I'm very proud and will value this award all the more for knowing that it came from you folks. Now, I did, like Leporello, come here with a little catalog. My catalog is of thank yous, which I think is customary for an occasion like this. First, I would like to say that only a very few years ago, I was drifting along in the doldrums of midlife, wondering from what direction the next breeze might come. When the winds finally arrived, they really started to blow. They picked up very rapidly, and I've been swept up in the current ever since. It is now appropriate to say a few words in gratitude. First, I would like to thank Anita and John. Without Miss Bryant and Mr. Briggs, I might never have come to feel that I just couldn't take that kind of stuff anymore. And I might never have started oozing out of my medicine cabinet. Next, I want to thank some of my fellow psychiatrists for helping me realize that shrinks need a lot of help, too. For example, I think of the prominent disciple of Freud, who wrote, "I can say with some justification that I have no bias against homosexuals. For me, they are sick people requiring medical help. They are essentially disagreeable, regardless of their pleasant or unpleasant outward manner. Their shell is a mixture of superciliousness, fake aggression, and whimpering. They are subservient when confronted with a stronger person, merciless when in power, unscrupulous about trampling on a weaker person. The only language their unconscious understands is brute force." And then I'd like to recall in gratitude the clinical acumen of the senior psychiatrist of the Menninger Foundation, who, after learning about the formation of gay doctors' groups, was quoted in the National Enquirer as follows: "These organizations are saying homosexuality is normal, which it isn't. If homosexuality is normal, then I'm just nuts." And also the psychiatrist who came to the rather remarkable conclusion that homosexuality is only abnormal for homosexuals. Quote, "Homosexuality invariably is a symptom of a psychological problem. However, in the absence of a sexual partner of the opposite sex, homosexuality is a normal outlet for a heterosexual man or woman." I now want to thank some other members of the medical profession for reminding me of the old injunction, "Physician, heal thyself." In this regard, I don't want to overlook the physician who was concerned about gays going public. Quote, "A question which no one has answered is whether or not the declaration of homosexuality itself constitutes a deviant behavior. The population as a whole has certainly regarded declarations of homosexuality associated with significant publicity as being at least maladaptive behavior." Or the sophistication of the Missouri physician, a state delegate to a meeting of the American Medical Association, who 2 months ago, when he learned of the existence of various gay doctors' groups, said that maybe there were some gay doctors in San Francisco and Los Angeles, but he was sure that there weren't any gay doctors in Missouri. Now, without these people, think of how empty and boring my life might have been. But enough of this bow to strangers. Let me come closer to home with some more direct and heartfelt thanks. First, to my mother and father. Because of all those questionable psychiatric theories, I am still not sure how much of what I am today they are or would want to feel responsible for. But however much it may be, I thank them both. My mother, by the way, although basically supportive, has suggested that I try to maintain a lower profile in the future. Therefore, I am announcing from this podium tonight that from now on, any of my public appearances or statements will be under the name of Gore Vidal. Let me thank our local pioneers who, from as early as the mid-1950s, were already active here in such groups as the Daughters of Bilitis, the Mattachine Society, and the Society for Individual Rights, long before it was safe or respectable to do any work of that sort. They're not exactly 49ers, they're more like 55ers, and by comparison, I am very much a nouveau gay. Let me thank my lucky stars for the great good fortune of being alive in this time and in this place for gay people, an absolutely unique one in the history of the world. And for having had the chance to experience the charisma of a Harvey Milk and the chutzpah of an Art Lazare. My deep and everlasting thanks to my good friends and colleagues in Bayer Physicians for Human Rights, in whose name I feel I'm really accepting this award tonight, and whose zest and commitment has already accomplished so much. Even closer to home, my love and gratitude to Steve, who has had to put up with quite a lot, which I hope he'll never tell anybody about. There are many, many others to whom I am indebted, and to those I will have to speak more privately. Finally, my sincere appreciation to all of you here and to all of the others who increasingly make it possible for all of us together to succeed. Thank you very much for having given me this continuing opportunity. I wouldn't want to have missed any of it.
And that about wraps it up on The Gay Life tonight. You've just heard Dr. David Kessler, MD, receive the Community Service Award from the Golden Gate Business Association. Earlier in tonight's show, you heard author, wit, social critic, and lecturer Gore Vidal give his own version of the State of the Union. The opinions expressed by guests on The Gay Life are not necessarily those of the producer, KSAN-FM, Mel Wright Incorporated, advertisers, or employees. Before we close, we have these public service announcements. Cinderella, A Dark Horse, a musical comedy review, is running through March, Saturdays only, at 8 and 10:30 at the Valencia Rose Cafe, 766 Valencia. For more information, 552-1445. Also at the Valencia Rose, every Monday night is open mic gay comedy night. The MCs are Carol Roberts and Tom Amiano. That's at 8:30, and it's only $2. The Valencia Rose is an ex-mortuary turned cafe and cabaret. For more information, dial 552-1445. The Bay Area Women's Float Committee is sponsoring its 1982 Float Design Competition for the Lesbian Gay Freedom Day Parade entry. There's a $100 prize, and the deadline is March 16th. Help the committee win another cable car award. Submit your design in the form of a drawing or three-dimensional model, which is preferable, by calling or attending a meeting Tuesdays at 7:30 p.m. upstairs at Amelia's, 647 Valencia. The deadline is March 16th. Call 922-2840. The Bay Area Women's Float Committee, 922-2840. Gay men who care for each other. Seeking new members for small, supportive, ongoing therapeutic groups. Gain a sense of belonging while dealing with the issues in your life. Call David Cooperberg, MA, at 431-3220 or Pedro Rojas, MA, at 841-9198. That's David Cooperberg, 431-3220, or Pedro Rojas, 841-9198. The Gay and Lesbian Switchboard at 841-6224
is staffed by trained volunteers from 10 to 10, Monday through Friday, and noon to 4 on Saturdays. For information about social services, things to do, or for direct counseling, call 841-6224. San Francisco Suicide Prevention needs volunteers to answer its crisis and information and referral lines. An 8-week training course is provided. For information, call 752-4866. That's 752-4866. Lesbian or gay and blind? Need information about Braille and cassette books on alternate lifestyles? Lambda Resource Center for the Blind in Chicago, Illinois is just for you. This nonprofit organization of blind and sighted volunteers records books not available elsewhere, distributes a list of books available from other sources, and issues LRC for the Blind quarterly on cassette. Contact by Braille, cassette, or print. Write LRC for the Blind, Post Office Box 1319, Chicago, Illinois, 60690. Telephone is area code 312-274-0511, evenings. That's LRC for the Blind, Post Office Box 1319, Chicago, Illinois, 60690. The telephone, area 312-274-0511, in evenings. 18th Street Services of the Pride Foundation is sponsoring a series of workshops for lesbians and gay men. The focus is on taking care of yourself, filling the vacuum, living sober, gaining confidence, and being lighter. All persons who want interaction not centered around drugs are welcome. Saturday afternoons from 1 to 5 p.m. at 4130 18th Street, a half a block from Castro. The cost is $10 per session if your monthly income is over $800. Otherwise, the cost will be $5 per session. Pre-registration is required. Phone 863-8111. Future topics in the Saturday afternoon workshops are the recovering couple, S&M and drugs, assertiveness training, massage, issues of the woman alcoholic, and for the best of health, on nutrition. For more information, once more, that's 863-8111. And the Rainbow Cattle Company at 199 Valencia at the corner of DuBose in San Francisco is offering live country music. Friday, March 12th, it's Cookie Baker and the Stetsons. Sunday, March 14th, the John Gallagher Band. Friday, March 19th, Randy and the Rounders. Sunday, March 21st, the Billy Band. Friday, March 26th, County Line. And Sunday, March 28th, One-Eyed Jack. For more information, the Rainbow Cattle Company, 861-9652. Next week, The Gay Life presents an interview with playwright Doric Wilson and director Alan Estes. Estes is currently directing the world premiere of Wilson's Street Theater at the...